I'd like now to introduce three fabulous writers, Anne Hillerman, David Morrell, and Christine Barber. Anne's new book is Spider-Woman's Daughter. David's new book is Murder as a Fine Art, which the Publishers Weekly just listed as one of the top 10 best mystery thrillers of 2013. And Christine's new book is When the Devil Doesn't Show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And we're talking about the Tony Hillerman Writers Conference, which is coming up very soon, coming up later this week at the Santa Fe Hilton.
That's right, November 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Yeah. So this is a writers' conference, of course, in the name of your father. What happens at this conference?
Well, the conference started really as a tribute to my father, and it started mainly focused on mysteries. And then as time went by, we broadened our scope to include all kinds of good writing. So Thursday, we have a pre-conference workshop, hands-on writing, people who really want that kind of workshop experience. Margaret Cole, a wonderful mystery writer from Colorado, is coming to talk about characters. And then in the afternoon, James McGrath Morris, who's a Santa Fe writer who wrote a wonderful biography of Joseph Pulitzer,
is going to
talk about beginnings and endings.
Right.
And then Friday is devoted to the craft of writing, and Saturday to the business of writing.
And so people who are writers at a very professional level or aspiring writers are all welcome to go to this event.
That's right. We get all kinds of people. We get people who've made a living writing, say, public information or writing nonfiction academic books, and they want to do something else. And then we get people who've always had the dream of, say, writing their stories for their families, and they haven't gotten started, so they see our conference as a way to get energized and get some good practical information, too.
So let's talk for a moment about your book, which I just read over the weekend, Spider-Woman's Daughter. You have done a very risky thing, which is basically you have taken the characters from your father's work, Tony Hillerman, and written a mystery, which is very good and very readable and really great fun, and of course set here in New Mexico, bringing those characters forward in their lives. How did you decide you were going to do that?
Well, with trepidation. I had worked with my dad on a nonfiction book, Tony Hillerman's Landscape, On the Road with Chi and Leaphorn. And as part of that book, I had reread all of his novels, a close reading this time. First time I just read them for story, but this time I really read them for the craft of writing. And as I was doing that, I really noticed his character Bernadette Manuelito. And I thought Bernie is originally introduced as a rookie cop who's rather infatuated with Sergeant Jim Chi. And then the books go on. After four books, Chi asks her to marry him. And then in Dad's last book, as it opens, Chi and Bernie are married and Leaphorn is delivering a wedding present to them. Anyway, I thought that this law enforcement person really deserved a chance to be more than just somebody's girlfriend, that she deserved a chance to solve the crime. And I had talked to my dad about that, and he agreed with me. Actually, I don't know if he was just agreeing with me because he was such a nice guy or if he really did agree with me. But in any case, after he died, the idea that Bernadette Manuelito deserved her own book really stuck with me. And also, I was missing those stories. I felt like I kind of grew up with Chi and Leaphorn. And after I got over the worst of missing my dad, I was thinking, well, what's going on with those guys? What's happened to them?
Yeah.
So I figured if anybody was going to continue the series, it would be me. So I had tried a couple of novels before, never written them through all the way to completion. So it was a stretch for me, but I'm really glad I did it. And I'm very happy with how the book came out.
So it's such a, I think, interesting and tricky business, because when you say, I miss Chi and Leaphorn, it's as if that on some parallel universe they're actually alive.
Yeah,
but,
that's right.
That universe, and if, one misses, for example, I mean, I miss characters when I finish reading novels. Sometimes I miss, like I went through the whole television series The Wire, and I miss the characters in that very long epic TV series as if they were real. And they are real in people's imaginations, but they were your dad's. and now you make them yours. And, like, how do you, you know, do they transform? Do they become your people? Do they change?
Yeah, they did change. I wasn't, when I started, I wasn't quite sure how they would change. Dad never did much with the relation. I mean, there was a lot of tension in the relationship between Chi and Bernie, but he never had a chance to write a book about them as a couple. So that was one change that I was able to bring forth in Spider-Woman's Daughter. I also was able to create some supporting characters and some new characters that are going to continue through my series. I was able to give Bernie a mother who has a lot of expectations of her, and a little sister who's really a handful.
Yeah, and she's a great character.
Oh, thanks. I had a lot of fun with her. And I thought, I mean, here's Bernie. She has a full-time job. She's just married. She has an elderly mother, so she needs a little more complication in her life. So that was how I came up with Darlene.
Right.
And I had a lot of fun, and I think coming up with the character, and I think both of those characters are going to continue now through the series.
It's, I think, fitting that a female author is going to have a female hero. That is kind of, I don't know if I've read enough mysteries to really say that, but is that kind of how it works?
Not always, no. I think it just depends on who is the best person to tell the story.
Yeah. So this is, of course, set in New Mexico. Do you feel like you know the state and all these places and characters well enough that you could just sit in your studio, or did you go out and do research and walk around the land? And
well, part of the book is set at Chaco Canyon, yeah. And that's a place I dearly love. I'd spent a lot of time there. But as I was working on the book, I made several trips back there. I wanted to make sure that I really got it right. And Dad had used Chaco Canyon in The Thief of Time, but he didn't really talk about the ruins. He just talked about the places where the employees live. So I figured that was there was a lot of fertile ground for me there. And then I used Shiprock, which, of course, is an iconic spot on the Navajo Reservation.
Yeah.
And then I brought the characters to Santa Fe. Dad had written some scenes with Joe Leaphorn in Santa Fe, but as far as I could find, the closest that Jim Chi ever got to it was the state penitentiary. He never was able to actually be here, just kind of walking around, enjoying the sights. So,
and he seems like a fish out of water here, I have to say.
Yeah. I'm glad you noticed that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought it would be fun to bring him and Bernie to Santa Fe and just see how they would react. And since I live in Santa Fe, it made it a little easier for me. It was one bit of research that I didn't have to do.
Now, one thing that you did, and since it's on about page 3 of the book, I don't think it's that we have to worry about giving the whole book away, but our dear Leaphorn gets pretty badly injured. Was that hard to do? I mean, did that hurt?
Well, no, because I knew how it would work out since I was creating this story. And I knew, too, that I had to really get people's attention right at the beginning. You know, I figured people are going to see, if they look at the book, they'll see the name Hillerman. And the first thing they'll think is, oh, good, Tony must have had another novel in his computer, in his desk drawer. And then when they see the name Anne, they'll think, uh-oh, what's this about? So I figured maybe I had 5 minutes. They would pick up the book. And if they're like me, they right. would look at how it starts, because that, particularly for a mystery, that's vital. So I knew I had to get their attention, you know, that I had that little five-minute window, maybe 5 minutes. So I just knew something dramatic had to happen. And also, in terms of Bernie coming into her own, she always has been in the shadow of the other detectives. So I needed there to be a crime where she was especially equipped to be the one to solve it.
So I think probably a lot of readers who have already read this book are kind of breathing a sigh of relief, because you've taken on this task to follow in your, you know, really great writer dad's footsteps. And if it had been a total debacle, that would be hard. Be hard for you and be hard for all of your public.
And it would have been so disappointing for the fans.
Yeah.
One thing that really encouraged me after I got the book done, my publisher asked me for the names of other writers I knew to send it to get little blurbs. And writers tend to be polite, but sometimes I know my dad did this, if you get a book that's just really awful, you hate to say, Don't waste your time. So you just say, gee, I'm just not going to have the chance to read this. You know, good luck to you.
Yeah.
But David Morrell was one of the people that my publisher sent the book to. And when he said that it was a worthy successor.
This was the question that every reader was going to ask, every fan of Tony's. That simply because Anne was related to Tony, did that mean that she should be writing these books? And I loved the book. My wife read it, and she loved it. And so I thought in the blurb, let's address the thing, the whole issue right away. And so the first line of my blurb was, this is a worthy successor. And I think that answered a lot of questions for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so too. And other writers that I sent it to, and a lot of them were writers I had met at the Tony Hillerman Conference. They were very generous with their praise of the book, and it really meant a lot to me. And I think that's one real value of the conference. People who are beginning writers have a chance to meet David Morrell, to meet Christine Barber, and then when their book is out, it's not so totally intimidating to ask for a favor or to ask somebody what they think of it. And of course, the writers they ask, you know, we're all really busy. People might say no. But at least I think it gives them some connections and a little more confidence.
You know, this is a good issue. I've been doing this 41 years. This is nobody's been in business 41 years writing novels, or a few people. But people ask me, what is my regret? If I could do it different, if I had wishes. And conferences didn't start until the mid-1980s, and really they developed. It was slow to get going, and the 90s it got more. And I remember thinking, once I started going to these conferences, now that they were available, isn't this cool? I get to hang around with other writers. Some are more advanced, some are less advanced, but they have all the same tone, which is collegiality. People, we're all in this together. We help each other. You know, it all floats. Every boat gets to float, so to speak. And so what you're saying about the conference is exactly true. And people will form friendships if they manage to go on and have careers. They will have bonds there that will last a lifetime. And in addition, they're meeting editors and agents and what have you. It's a wonderful opportunity to become less innocent about writing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, and it really gives you a sense of community. For me, every time I go to a conference, I sometimes learn something new with a little trick, but then it reminds you of the things that you should be doing while you're writing. So I don't know if that's true for you, David, that when you go still, you've been doing it 41 years, that you still find that when you go to a conference, you're like, oh, that's a really good point. And it's like you keep learning how to write, which should be so
basic.
Well,
I go to the, Dan knows, I sit in on a lot of the sessions because you're in medicine. You're training to be a physician. People in medicine go back and get retrained. I mean, yeah. I'm a pilot. Yeah, every 2 years you have to go back and get prove that you know what you're doing. And I think the conferences are the same way, that you need to come in contact with new ideas and sort of jolt yourself.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, the ongoing question of how to write and all of that is one part of it. And then another part of it is the business of writing, which of course has changed dramatically
every month
since I started doing this show 10 years ago.
Oh yeah.
Every month it's I can't keep up with it. So I appreciate the technical sessions that people have about is the business of it. It's not so much that we want to say, oh hey, we're producing a product. I hate that kind of talk. I'm a novelist. I'm not a marketer, a merchandiser, but I think that we have to be aware of changes, especially what's happened with e-books. Only 4 years ago, the e-book revolution occurred, and you really have to be aware of its implications.
Yeah. Are you guys selling a lot of books on e-books? Do you know?
I am, yes.
Yeah.
I think I am, because people will say, I've read your book on my Kindle.
Very interesting. I had an opportunity to read a book on a Kindle recently, and I hated it.
Why is that?
Well, I was reading a nonfiction book, and the way I read nonfiction books is in a nonlinear way. I read the first and the last chapter and a middle chapter, and I you know, reference back to something that it said in chapter one to make sure that I got it right when I'm on chapter three. And it's very hard to do that.
I'm with you.
Yeah,
I agree with
right.
you. I do not read nonfiction on as an ebook.
Fiction might be better.
Fiction is a different thing.
Yeah.
The big thing for me with ebooks is you can magnify the print, the
yeah,
font.
That was cool.
And of course you can, for traveling, take, you know,
73 books in a tiny little.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So we're talking about the Tony Hillerman Writers Conference, which is happening this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Santa Fe Hilton right here in town. And Christine Barber and David Morrell are going to be giving presentations. Christine, yours is called Write a Winning Novel. What will you be doing during that? You were the original Tony Hillerman Prize winner.
And that's correct. And so since then, and then that was back in 2008, there has always been the question in my mind of why did the judges choose my book? What about it was interesting to them? And then what can I improve for the next one? And I think that's probably a pretty universal question, which is, what about this book that I just wrote, or this paragraph I just wrote, this email text that is going to draw somebody in? What was that quality? And so what I did for my presentation I'm doing on Saturday is I asked judges from the Hillman Prize, from the Edgars, which is the Mystery Writers of America Prize, the Pulitzers, the National Book Award, and then editors at Macmillan, about what is the one thing that will make you put a manuscript, meaning a new novel, in a reject pile. And the answers were pretty much what you might suspect, bad grammar, things like that. But then it was also other little tiny things. And it goes back to what David and I were talking about earlier, which is, it doesn't hurt to be reminded of the fact that character is so important, or that setting is so important. And that needs to kind of keep in your mind every single section you write, every single chapter you write. You need to remember those things every time. And so that's what I'll be talking about.
It's interesting because when you hear that, how to write a prize-winning novel, I mean, the danger in that is that the young author will have his or her eyes on the prize instead of really on the book.
So I think that they might have their eyes on the prize initially, but once they start writing the book, they'll realize it's really hard, and that writing in and of itself is such a talent and such an art that it is not an easy thing. There are much easier ways to get money. I think I write about the prizes more for people who are already interested in writing, have a book or have an idea that's sitting in a closet somewhere, and they think, oh, could I do this? Oh, I'm not going to. Because that was me before I won the Hillerman Prize. And it literally was. My book sat around for 7 years before I entered it in the Hillerman Prize. And so those are the people I'm trying to reach, to say, you got this book. Here are some things you can use to jazz it up. Here are the prizes to get yourself kind of started, because I would never have made it into this business without winning the prize.
Very interesting. Now, is that a prize for unpublished authors?
Yes, it is. Who are writing a mystery that is based in the Southwest. And the Southwest kind of includes a fairly large area. And we do have a website that gives all of the information.
And the author can be published in other fields. You could
yes.
have written children's books,
right.
nonfiction, but it has to be a first mystery.
Very interesting. So since then, you have written several books, Christine, and you've gone to medical school.
Correct.
And you continue to write books.
Yes. I don't know that I'm doing either particularly well, because I'm spending my time so much, but I'm trying.
Are you using medicine as part of your mystery thriller kind of material?
Not at all, because I find writing such an amazing break from medicine. Medicine is science, medicine is facts, and I love it. But at the same time, the creativity, the creation of something is really exciting as well. And so I'll hear these stories, and my books are set in Santa Fe, and I'll hear these stories about things that happen here, or I'll know things that happen here, and I'll say, I've got to put that into a book. And the medicine, I use that to like make sure my genetics things I talk about are correct in this. When the devil doesn't show, there were some genetics things that happened. But other than that, I don't really usually combine the two very much.
Although you do have some EMTs.
I do. I started off as an EMT in Santa Fe. And so I use a lot of calls I've heard about, calls I went on to kind of sprinkle in there and kind of make it a little bit more, this is how medicine is out in the field. So I do have that. Thank you, Anne.
Now, David Morrell, you are giving a presentation on Friday called Murder as a Fine Art, which is also the name of your latest book, the literary thriller that pushes the envelope. What's that about?
Well, I'm concerned that too many writers, to use your expression earlier, the eye on the prize, that are treating this as a business. I see it not as a profession, but as a vocation. And I think that's one reason I lasted 41 years is because I kept always using it as a level of personal expression. So I have mantras such as don't chase the market or be a first-rate version of yourself and not a second-rate version of another author. Now, I can't guarantee that anybody will be a successful author in the sense of able to earn a living at it because, I mean, yeah, we do want to earn some money, but that's a sort of dividend from the self-expression. I can't guarantee that anybody will be able to earn a living doing that because maybe they don't have the abilities, but I do guarantee they'll feel better about themselves rather than trying to write material that they don't, that isn't authentic to them.
Yeah, right.
So my talk, when I did... I'm known as a writer of contemporary American subjects. I mean, I created Rambo, for heaven's sakes, in a novel called First Blood. That's hard to get in terms of an American topic, Vietnam and all of that. So 3-4 years ago, I fell in love with the Victorian period. And there were lots of reasons not to pursue that love because would my fans come with me? Would they migrate? And there were a number of editors and fellow authors who told me, oh, for God's sake, don't do that.
Why?
But because it was going to be, they felt, ruinous for me that I would lose my existing readers and not pick up anybody else because it was so different.
You mean you're writing stuff set in the Victorian period?
Yes, in 1854 London. And to write it as, this was the fun of it, to write it as an imitation, a thriller as an imitation Victorian novel, which taught people about how weird the Victorian world was. So I just said to myself, you know what, I've been doing it this long, what do I care? I'm going to write, I spent 2 years researching this book. For 2 years, all I read was material related to 1854 London. I got the equivalent of a doctorate, Morrell University doctorate in Victorian culture, so that I could write this book. The whole enterprise was 3 years. And so, you know, in it goes, and it's, in a sense, it's all an act of faith. And by God, people responded. They sensed the passion. They sensed the risk that I was taking and were willing to go with me on it. And so, in a sense, even though I'm going to be talking about this book that I have written, what I'm really trying to do is use myself as an example of be yourself. Go with what you love rather than what you think is going to sell because nobody knows. Nobody knows.
Well, I think one thing that makes your book so appealing is that it's so authentic. Reading it, it's like being on those streets in Victorian England. And your use of language, some of those wonderful, obscure Victorian words, that they're just so amazing.
The main character is a real person named Thomas De Quincey who was the first person to write about drug addiction in a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And De Quincey is just a glorious writer. So, and he had written an essay called On Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts. So I thought, all right, this is cool. I'm going to use him. I'm going to abbreviate his title, The Murder as a Fine Art. And a lot of the phrases you're talking about came from him. I reread his thousands and thousands. He was very prolific. I mean, somebody said that I'd become a ventriloquist for De Quincey.
Ha.
And so, you know, the book had to feel like it was written in 1854. And And if I can, just before we get back to the conference, I knew when I had it nailed, when I knew how much a middle class or upper class woman's clothes weighed in 1854, and the answer is 37 pounds.
Good heavens.
Yes. Now, the question is, why is that? It's because in that decade, hoop skirts were the vogue, hoop dresses. Now, these were metal contraptions of a size that were worn under the dresses, or whale's teeth, both of which had a hefty weight to them.
Pre-titanium.
Ten yards of ruffled satin were required to cover these things. Now, we can imagine carrying around 10 yards of satin all day, but then it got better because the hoops popped up all the time. So the dear ladies had to wear all these numerous undergarments for modesty reasons, and they still were having trouble. And they finally said, oh, to heck with it, and they began putting lead weights in the dresses. So by the time they were done, they were carting around 37 pounds of this stuff. So when I knew that, I said, all right, I'm insufficiently inside that culture I can write about it.
Yeah.
How did they sit down?
Well, that was the problem. They would sit down, and then they'd crush the, because these were pliant under, you know, the cages were pliant. So if you sat down, they would fold underneath you. The front would want to lift up, so you'd have to use your hands in order to push down the dress over your knees. Now, this meant that, like, the primary conveyances back then were Hansom cabs and coaches and what have you, or the omnibus, which translated in today's double-decker buses in London. And so, you know, to get on those with the hoop skirts, you couldn't do it. You couldn't go out on the street, because at this phased out. It was from 1851, from the first World's Fair, until about 1860. And then they said, you know, this is nuts.
Yeah.
And then you begin to get the big
whatever,
bustles. There we go. And with the skirt hanging down, or the dress hanging down.
Which were positively balletic in their flexibility compared to the hoop skirts.
In comparison, yeah. Oh, it was a nightmare. You know, people were squeezing to get through doorways and all that. But,
and the working class people must have been laughing at
them. They were, yes. Because they couldn't afford all this junk.
Yeah. And like, look at those crazy people torturing themselves.
And they were crazy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we're going to get you on the air to talk about this book in a few weeks, dog willing.
I'd love to. Yeah.
So, but
tell you all kinds of Victorian stories.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's amazing. But your presentation, when you talk about pushing the envelope, I mean, this thing about be yourself reminded me of that Oscar Wilde quote: "Be yourself. Everyone else is taken."
Well, it's true. You know, I sometimes do a motivational session, and I say, look, each of us is a totally unique individual. The forces that came together to make us what we are can never be replicated. We are amazing individuals. And my theory is that people want to be, I'll qualify that. Some people want to be writers because they think there's a lot of money in it, and for most people there is not. But if we set that aside, and people have an absolute compulsion to write because of putting words on the page, I think it's because they're psychologically damaged. I know I am. And Graham Greene once said, "An unhappy childhood is a gold mine for a writer."
Yeah.
And I believe this implicitly. That now, it doesn't have to be terrors like child abuse. It could be a parent who simply didn't pay attention. I had a friend who wanted desperately to be a writer so that she could bring a novel she had published to her father and say, here, see, I can do something. So that, and my writing teacher back at Penn State used to say that each of us is controlled by a dominant emotion, jealousy, hate, whatever. In my case, it's fear, because I had a tough upbringing. And so that the idea was to channel that dominant emotion and basically write books that reflect, you know, what our secrets are. But most people don't want to reveal their secrets.
Yeah.
I did have, after one of these sessions, a guy came up to me and he says, I know what you mean, dominant emotion. I've got it now. My dominant emotion is lust. So he was going to go off, and he was going to go off and write pornography. So
yeah.
I thought, that's great. Hey,
that's,
if it's authentic, go with it, man.
We are primates. And we're talking about the Hillerman Conference.
Believe it or
lust
not.
Lust at the Hillerman Conference.
which is happening this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and the public is invited, and I guess people come from far and wide for this.
Yeah, this year we have several people coming from Canada, as well as from all over the United States. When we first started the conference, the model for conferences in New Mexico was that you would bring in some big author from New York, and then lowly New Mexicans would sit at his feet and learn what wisdom he had to give us. And when Gene Schomburg and I started the Hillerman Conference, we thought New Mexico has so many wonderful writers. It would be great to bring people from elsewhere here to see what kind of talent we've got. So that's been basically our plan.
We have a tremendous amount of authors and other creative people in New Mexico. It is, the more I think about it, the more astonishing. George R.R. Martin, that George R.R. Martin lives in Santa Fe is so cool, and that he would buy a local movie theater, the John Cocteau, and sort of, you know, turn it into his playground. In order to show all these cool movies, how wonderfully weird is that?
Yeah. This is a crazy state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
Yeah. And it's why it's a great place, I suppose, for writers to both live and to set their books.
Yeah, I think that's really true. People don't look at you funny if you say you're a writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they might say, what do you write? And then if you're David Murrell, they might look at you funny.
Well, the funny, what they say, they always shake their head from side to side. I don't suppose there's anything you've written that I would have read. This is the universal thing that every author gets. It's I sometimes, if I don't want to put up with this conversation in a social context, I'll say I'm a retired literature professor. And nobody wants to talk to it. I am. I was a literature professor at the University of Iowa. But nobody wants to talk to a retired literature professor. So, like, on a plane, very cool. What do you do for a living? I'm a retired literature professor. Oh, okay. And that's the end of that conversation.
Whereas if you say I'm a thriller writer,
then
they want to pick your
brain.
What
do you write? And then it goes on.
And they probably have a lot of ideas for you,
they
too.
They do. So I got this great idea. I'll give you the ideas. You just write it.
So the Hillerman Conference, the Tony Hillerman Writers Conference, is happening November 7th, 8th, and 9th at the Santa Fe Hilton in downtown Santa Fe, New Mexico. And for more information, people can go to wordharvest.com.
Yeah, that's right. Or they can call. At this point, it might be best to call Gene Schomburg.
Oh, okay.
And we should remember that we also have a very special Craig Johnson is going to be there, the creator of the Longmire novels and the television series.
What is Gene Schomburg's phone number if people want to register?
It's 471-1565.
471-1565. And actually, so this is starting tomorrow, so people better get on it.
Can you just show up at the door? Yes. And particularly for the pre-conference workshop, which is Thursday. Which is tomorrow. Yeah, the other sessions are pretty much full. People are welcome to come and see if we have some cancellations.
Ah, okay.
But Friday and Saturday, this is the most popular year we've ever had. I think in part because of David's new book, because of Craig Johnson, who is the Johnson is the originator of the Longmire series, which was really popular on A&E. And maybe a little buzz about my new book.
Yep. Yeah, you bet. Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you all very much for being here, Ann Hillerman, David Murrell, and Christine Barber. Thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.